This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, Ben Bernanke tells it like it is. Business owners in Moore, Oklahoma get going on rebuilding and the seedy side of the south of France. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 22nd of May. And on the calendar of the chairman of the Federal Reserve today was this annotation: go tell Congress what's going on with the economy. So Ben Bernanke took yet another trip up Capitol Hill and said basically this about that.
I don't know. It's going to depend on the data.
All right. He said way more than that, but you get the point. Lawmakers wanted to know when things are really going to turn around, when the Fed is going to stop keeping interest rates low, when unemployment might stop being such a problem. I'll just hit that tape one more time.
I don't know. It's going to depend on the data.
There you go. Almost 2 hours of congressional testimony in, what, 20 seconds? Anyway, the bigger attraction on Capitol Hill this week, so far anyway, has been Tim Cook and Apple and how that company fills out its tax forms. We talked about it a bit yesterday. Apple and bazoodles of other American companies keep big chunks of their profits overseas and thus beyond the reach of the IRS. Tax havens that you've surely heard of: the Cayman Islands, Singapore, Ireland as well. And one you might not know about. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith packed her sunscreen and swimsuit to check it out.
I'm just steps away from the water, and a warm island breeze is caressing my face. I'm standing in front of a multinational bank where billions of dollars in offshore corporate profits are probably stored. The island is Manhattan, and I'm outside of a Citibank in Midtown, and I think that warm breeze was actually bus exhaust. Turns out many U.S. companies are storing some of their offshore profits in banks here at home.
You don't really have to keep money offshore to keep it offshore.
Larry Zelenak teaches corporate tax law at Duke. He says pretty much all of the multinationals do it.
It's kind of standard operating procedure.
It works like this. A U.S. company sets up a foreign subsidiary in a country with a low tax rate and routes its overseas profits through that unit. Those profits technically belong to the foreign subsidiary, even if they're sitting in a U.S. bank account. Michael Knoll co-directs the Center of Tax Law and Policy at UPenn. He says a company
can invest its money wherever it likes, and the U.S. tax laws look at that as the money not of the parent, but of the subsidiary.
That allows U.S. companies to avoid paying the 35% corporate tax rate, one of the highest in the world. But the offshore, onshore money can be put to use in the U.S. economy. Howard Gleckman is with the Tax Policy Center.
The fact that the money is sitting in a U.S. bank presumably makes the money available to U.S. borrowers. But as we know, U.S. banks have not been lending. It's one of the reasons why the recovery from the recession has been so slow.
Gleckman says it certainly doesn't make up for the billions of dollars in taxes the government loses every year. In the exotic tax haven that is Midtown Manhattan, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I don't know what the heck happened at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Manhattan today. Blame Bernanke, blame somebody, I don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Officials in Moore, Oklahoma, said today they're pretty sure they've recovered the bodies of all of those who died in the tornado Monday, which means the long road to putting things and lives back together again can begin in earnest. Homes and businesses were destroyed by the dozens, and if history is any guide, figuring out how to get the aid money that's going to let people rebuild is going to be complicated. Gaydon McGee is one of those business owners. Her company in Moore is called Ideal Hearing Solutions. We got her on a cell phone on her way out of town. Ms. McGee, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
First of all, you're all right, obviously, but your business, I gather, the building, maybe not so much.
No, not at all. It looks like a blender. It was put in a blender. It was right on the highway, right where the tornado crossed I-35, so it was right there.
And now what do? You have what I understand is a brand new business with no building.
Yes, I opened in November so that I could have my own practice in Moore. I'm the only hearing aid center in Moore, Oklahoma, and was doing good, got everything up and running and got everybody knowing where I was. Then just all of a sudden you don't have anything, you're unemployed.
Well, do you have even the slightest idea of what to do now with FEMA and federal disaster money and Small Business Administration? There will be a maze of paperwork you're going to have to go through.
Yes, that's the problem. Being fairly new to business, having my own business, and they put out that, yes, they're going to have a place that we're supposed to go to and some different things to do. It's just it's a mess.
Are you going to rebuild or might you go somewhere else?
Well, I was leasing that location, so I will have to go somewhere else. I want to stay in Moore. I graduated from Moore and have connections there. I want to stay there, family there. So it's just I'm going to have to go to a little bit different location, obviously.
What about your business records and your finance forms and your tax documents and your patient records and all of that?
Well, luckily, I did find my patient records, and I have a CPA that's off-site, so I send stuff to her. I just don't have this month's stuff over there. So that was the saving grace because I didn't get the computer back up because it wasn't even raining when we left. So, and we just left to run errands and to do things because I was going out of town today.
Yeah, you're going where? You're going to Tombstone, Arizona, and that to me is the best part of this whole story.
Yes, I work with the Guthrie Gunfighters, and I'm a gunfighter, and we basically dress up in Victorian or period clothing and do street performing or gunfighting and reenact different parts of the West. And there's gunfights every 15 minutes.
Do you have to, like, fall down and die like we did when we were kids when you got shot?
Sometimes I do. But, you know, most of the time I'm an outlaw when I die or maybe a Miss Kitty type.
Wow.
If I get shot. But a lot of times I just cause trouble. So, yeah. So.
I hope it takes your mind off your troubles, Ms. McGee.
First day it happened, I have to say I was a little, maybe not grumpy, but a little not having my best day. But by the next day, it starts sinking in and you start putting it in perspective that all my children are safe. Everyone I know in my connection that I know of is safe. And, of course, some people can't say that. And that out of, you know, if I had a choice, I would choose to lose my business over friends or children. You have to kind of put it where it's not the end of the world, you know.
Gaydon McGee, she owns a company called Ideal Hearing Solutions in Moore, Oklahoma. Ms. McGee, best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Labor unions in France are threatening to go on strike. That is not, I realize, an especially helpful headline. So here's some context. It's not about austerity measures or further cuts in wages and pensions. It is even more controversial. The government wants to ease a ban on using English in French universities. From the European Desk Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
France's Ministry of Higher Education is trying to kill a sacred cow, the legal requirement that all subjects, other than foreign languages, must be taught in French. Douglas Yates at the American University in Paris.
The minister is just trying to loosen the restrictions on teaching classes in English because the business schools need to teach in English, because scientists need to deal with the scientific community that's in English.
By lifting the ban on English as a medium of instruction, the government hopes to attract many more foreign students to French universities.
If we teach in English, then we have more people coming here.
Fabrice Rousselot, editor of the left-leaning newspaper Libération. He says teaching in the world's most popular foreign language will also help French students. It'll equip them to go out and sell French products and services anywhere abroad.
Our French, you know, youth is going to be able to go, you know, around the world instead of, you know, being afraid of the world, to conquer the world in some ways.
But the plan to lower the protection of the French language is raising national hackles.
Our public policy is to broaden French influence and French language.
Conservative lawmaker Jacques Millard calls the new measure supine and says it's a mistake to focus only on English.
I'm sorry to say that English is declining, as the United States of America. I'm sorry to say.
But most opponents of the new measure are worried about the perceived threat to the French language. Georges Gastel of a French language defence group says, I'm resisting the replacement of our language by another.
Si la France cesse de parler français, c'est quoi la France après?
He says, what is France without French? But even he, the purist, exemplifies the relentless encroachment of English. In our interview in French, he complained about le French bashing and spoke of le business lobby. Franglais, if ever I heard it. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It starts in the bottom and then goes up and up and up. And the higher up you go, the better quality distributor and exhibitors you get.
The part of Cannes and its film festival you've never heard about. But first, let's do the numbers. Mixed signals over when the Fed plans to scale back its debt buying program. It'll depend on the data. That's what the man said, right? Upended markets today. The Dow Industrials off 80 points, about 0.5%, ended at 15,307. The NASDAQ off 38 points, 0.1%, closed at 3463. The S&P 500 ditched 13 points, 0.8%. Finished at 1655. Was an up day for most of the session, though. Retail chain Target caught a chill today, posted lower quarterly profits, blaming a cold spring for keeping shoppers indoor. Shares tumbled 4% today. Investors, however, took a shine to jewelry store Zales. Its stock sparkled up 22% on strong earnings and news that its new chairman is the former CEO of the company that owns rival K Jewelers. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. The Labor Department releases its weekly jobless claims. In 1995, the first version of the programming language Java was released. And last but not least, it's World Turtle Day. Started 13 years ago, it's supposed to increase knowledge of and respect for the world's turtles and tortoises. Ways to observe include dressing up as a turtle or simply wearing green. So there you go. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's a toss-up, or maybe not even that, as to whether there's going to be another congressional vote on gun control this year. Advocates are trying to make it happen, trying to get some kind of expanded background check passed. Not often heard in that debate so far, though, is anything about firearms training. Only a couple of states require any before you buy a gun, which, as the demographics of gun ownership change, is of interest to industry and experts alike, as Marketplace's David Gura tells us.
Preston Whittington lives in Tupelo, Mississippi.
Well, we keep the firearm back in our closet, towards the back of the house, right off our...
A few months ago, he bought a handgun, a Glock 19, just in case.
You know, I have a family, I have a two-year-old son, and one of the things that has been in the forefront of my mind, especially since he was born, is providing for and defending my family.
Whittington is among a growing number of American gun owners. A recent survey found that half of all gun purchases were for self-defense. That's up from a quarter in 1999. Whittington's gun set him back $575. It took him a while to save up for it, but his spending didn't stop there. He forked over almost $250 for training on how to use his gun.
I was not going to buy a firearm unless I signed up for training and safety classes the exact same day.
Whittington calls a firearm a tool that has the ability to cause a lot of damage. And as he puts it, he needed to learn how to behave with one. Whittington didn't grow up with guns.
To be honest with you, it was just something, since I was never exposed to it, I never understood the need for it. And it was just never a part of my life, so it wasn't something that I was passionate about.
That changed 5 years ago. Whittington had moved to the U.S.-Mexico border to work at a factory in Nogales. He remembers the photos in newspapers of violence related to the drug trade.
And the more I began to see what was going on in Mexico, the more I started to think about my own safety and my own ability to defend myself here in the States.
Whittington and his wife debated whether or not to become gun owners for 3.5 years. And when they finally decided to, Whittington was struck by something: how easy it is. In Mississippi, there's no permit needed and no training required to buy a gun.
You fill out some paperwork and they do a quick background check. And if everything checks out, then you're able to walk away with the firearm the same day.
That's how it works in many states. Phil Cook teaches public policy at Duke University. He says that even in states with what are considered to be the strictest gun laws, you can buy a firearm without any hands-on training.
I think what worries a lot of us is that with all of the talk about guns and self-defense, that we now have novices walking into gun stores and buying a gun who really know nothing about it.
Preston Whittington fires off a few rounds at the Ridge Crossing Shooting Club. This is where he came after he bought his pistol. Most gun owners who get formal training get it in the military. Marine Corps recruits study marksmanship for 3 weeks. That kind of training would cost a civilian thousands of dollars. Whittington and his wife took a private lesson from Nikki and Dee Dee Carter on a Sunday afternoon. The Whittingtons paid $75 each. Nikki Carter says he always starts in the classroom with 2 hours on safety.
And then we go into mostly your fundamentals, your sight picture, your grip, your stance, breathing, trigger control, all your basic fundamentals in shooting.
Dee Dee Carter says demand for training has been up since President Obama was reelected and since the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut.
We are booked into September at this point.
Roughly 1.5 million Americans are expected to take a firearms training course this year. The Whittingtons had to wait 2 months for a lesson. Meanwhile, that Glock sat locked away in a safe on a shelf.
I would feel more comfortable if everyone else that owned a gun around me, if I knew that they had taken the same safety training.
Right now, there's no way to know what training they've had, if any at all. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Companies selling or otherwise profiting from our personal information is nothing new. Wireless phone companies, Verizon among them, have been selling information about our physical location and the websites we visit. And yes, there is usually the choice to opt out of that kind of thing. If only that were as easy as it sounds, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
When I go on Verizon's website, the option to opt out and limit the sharing of consumer data is not immediately obvious.
Opting out of data brokers and advertising schemes is notoriously difficult.
Adi Kamdar is with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is dedicated to protecting digital rights. He says some websites try to hide the opt-out option.
Other sites make it so that you need to provide more information about yourself in order to opt out, and sometimes people feel weird or creeped out about doing that.
Companies have a financial incentive to discourage us from opting out. Jeff Chester is executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, a consumer privacy group.
Today, your data is the new gold. It's the currency that companies are trading back and forth and making tens of billions of dollars on. So, of course, companies like Verizon or Facebook don't want you to opt out.
He favors a national privacy law that would restrict the trading of personal information. But until then, it's up to us. Many people protect their privacy by clearing the tracking cookies from their computer. But Adi Kamdar says that approach can backfire because companies use cookies to identify which consumers have chosen to opt out.
As soon as you clear your opt-out cookie, too, you opt back into this data broker's scheme.
So if you clear the cookies from your computer, you'll need to start over and opt out all over again. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
As any fan will tell you, sports officials in pretty much any sport that matters take a risk when they mess with the rules. Think about the designated hitter rule in baseball, for instance. More than 40 years later, people still grumble about it. Heresy, by the way, if you ask me, but I digress. Golf's rulemakers have agreed to ban what is known as the belly putter. They say forcing golfers to use a regular putter instead of one that can be anchored to your belly keeps the game pure, which is a worthy goal. But how to do that, or anything in any sport for that matter, without turning off the paying public? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
There can be a lot riding on rules. University of Chicago economist Alan Sanderson says, think about Jackie Robinson.
That was chancy. It was the moral thing to do and everything else, but you know, there were some risks attached to that.
Sanderson says team owners were gambling. White audiences would pay to see non-white athletes compete. Generally, sports owners are in business to make money. Holy Cross economics professor Victor Matheson says in recent years, sports have focused on adding some razzle-dazzle.
We've seen lots of rule changes in the NBA and in the NFL and in hockey, all designed to encourage more offense, more scoring.
But there's a limit. Take baseball. Performance-enhancing drugs helped drive the infamous home run races between Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, and Sammy Sosa. But Chicago's Alan Sanderson says the customer balked.
At some point, fans just said, enough is enough.
Sports economists tend to agree the biggest sports rule riddle out there today is professional football. The NFL must figure out how to protect its players. Right now, it's not clear how to do that. Professor Matheson at Holy Cross says, to understand what's at stake, look at boxing.
There was essentially no way to take the brutality out of boxing, and boxing has went from being perhaps the most glorified sport in the country down to a sport that essentially no one watches anymore.
Matheson says if the NFL doesn't figure out how to adjust its game, the nearly $10 billion in revenue it took in last year could be in jeopardy. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We're a week or so into the Cannes Film Festival. It is prestigious, as you know, artsy, very, very French, but at the same time, very much down with the grittier side of global capitalism. Wesley Morris writes on films at Grantland. He is in Cannes this week. Hey, Wesley, how are you, man?
Hey, Kai. Greetings from Cannes, France.
So, first of all, I hear it's raining. You must just be miserable, right?
I'm pretty miserable, I gotta tell you. Look, there are a lot worse places in the world I could be right now, but it is a little bit sad that it's raining. But that's all the complaining you're gonna get out of me. I'm totally done.
That's right, because that's all the complaining I'm gonna give you. I want to talk about two things today. One is Cannes as a barometer, a bellwether, if you will, of the film industry, and then this whole sales thing, this marché that they have. First of all, what is the vibe? Are people excited about movies this year?
Well, it depends on who you are. The people going to the festival are really excited about movies.
Yeah.
The buyers are, I mean, there are definitely deals being made. But in a lot of ways, it's several different festivals, you know. And I think depending on what your function is in the festival, it affects the quality of time you have.
Talk to me a little bit about that. How many layers are there to this thing? I mean, it's a movie festival, for crying out loud.
Let's see. So we'll start with just the basic official selection, which is what they call all the movies that the festival programmers choose to have in the festival. So There's, you know, the handful of movies that are eligible for the Palme d'Or, which is the films that Steven Spielberg, who's the president of this year's jury, and Nicole Kidman and Ang Lee will all decide. This is the best jury in a long time.
Yeah.
And then you have with this sort of larger business situation, which is that there are a lot of movies here, solely for the purpose of international distribution. And so what you have in the Palais complex, basically, mm-hmm. it starts in the bottom and then goes up and up and up. And the higher up you go, the better quality distributor and exhibitors you get. And
is it literally you start in the basement with the garbage movies and then you move up and you get better as you go higher in the building?
Pretty much. I mean, although you can find terrible movies on every floor, the way it's stratified also somewhat kind of reflects the way the global marketplace works. I mean, yeah. You have a lot of third world countries on the third floor in the basement, essentially.
And these guys are here. Those folks are there literally just to be bought. They're just taking advantage of the pure capitalism of the global film
industry.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, it's the opposite of what people think this festival is. You know, walking through the Marché, which I do a couple times every time I come here, is just a really good reality check about what really matters in terms of the global movie distribution yeah. and production marketplace. But it basically inside the Marché, it looks like your average convention. And, you know, the places that have more prestige have the nicer stalls.
That's so disillusioning, I have to tell you.
What did you think it was?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was better than that. The interesting thing, of course, is that the movie business is all about global distribution, right? We here in the States like to think it's all about American audiences, but really it's all about making that money overseas so you can finally get in the black with these films. Most of them, anyway.
Oh, my God. That's where all the money is.
Yeah.
I mean, the focus of the movie industry now is just making as much money around the world as you can. And North America is a small but not insignificant part of that. But you want basically – your goal is global domination.
Wesley Morris, he writes for Grantland. He's in Cannes, France, enjoying the rain. Wesley, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which we will settle now and for all time the burning question of how you pronounce these three little letters when they are strung together, G, I, and F. The guy who invented the graphics interchange format, which lets images on your computer screen move, kind of like animation, got a Webby Lifetime Achievement Award last night. Steve Wilhite is his name. He's had a stroke, so he can't speak, but you can check out the video of his acceptance presentation from the ceremony last night, in which he laid down the law. It's GIF, people, like the peanut butter GIF. Remember that. All right, the link is on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. With that is Marketplace from APM, the radio show. Today, the Dow off 80 points, a half of 1%. The NASDAQ down 38 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 ditched 13 points, 0.8%. Carlos Asensio, Robbie Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.